Hello, everyone. How very nice to be together again to be sharing these great teachings.
And this morning, we want to welcome you to the Wednesday morning class of Inner Renewal Week. And our topic for this morning will be how to live in conversation with Yogananda based on Swamiji's collected works, Conversations with Yogananda. And there it is. So without further ado, we will have a prayer, and Jyotish loves to blow the conch to get us ready for the battle of light against darkness, and then we'll have our class.
Let's pray together. Get centered in your spine. Really what we're trying to do is move the energy up the spine to the spiritual eye. So feel that you're ready to do that, and let's pray together. Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, Friend, Beloved God, Great Masters, Jesus Christ, Babaji Krishna, Lahiri Mahashaya, Swami Sri Yukteswar, Beloved Guru, Paramahansa Yoganandaji, Saints of all religions, we humbly bow to you all. Bless us with thy grace and thy guidance in our spiritual search. We seek to merge with thee, to become one with thy light, thy joy, thy love. Om. Peace. Amen. And we'll blow the conch to awaken the inner chakras and also to begin the battle of light against dark.
Now we'll have one of Swami Kriyananda's songs. Good morning once again. I remember many years ago when we were having a spiritual renewal week gathering that Swamiji, Swami Kriyananda, was leading. He was giving all the classes, all the evening programs. And at one point, he said something that I had a hard time accepting. It took me a while. He said, "You all thank me for what I do, but I want you to know that I need you as much as you need me, because if I didn't have sincere students with which to share, I wouldn't be able to fulfill my dharma that my guru gave me." So I just want to preface our class for speaking for Jyotish and me and the wonderful teachers yesterday and the ones that will be speaking in the upcoming classes, what a blessing it is for us to be able to share with you these wonderful teachings, to go deep in them, and to help us as a spiritual family to deepen our own life in God. So So as we said, today we're going to be basing our talk on the book Conversations with Yogananda. But we're calling the talk, and it gives you an idea of the direction we're taking with it, how to live in conversation with Yogananda. It makes it more personal, doesn't it? The book is a marvelous book. It's over nearly 500 different selections that Swami wrote down during Master's life, during the years Swamiji was with him, the end of Master's life. And it covers such a wide range of topics. And if you're not aware, Swami did a daily television show in India, and you can watch the recordings of it, focusing on each one of these different offerings, conversations with Yogananda. It's really well worth watching, meditating on. But I want to not only talk about, Jyotish and I want to talk not just about this particular offering or that particular offering, but major themes that appear in the book. And Master had such, and the direction that I'll take is to look at the seven different themes, but from this perspective, first, the natural and spontaneous way that Master shared his wisdom. It was not at all, "Lo, I say unto you," but it was in a way you didn't even know that the profundity of his wisdom was being shared. It just seemed so self-evident. And in fact, that was one of my problems when I first came to Ananda and began hearing Swami Kriyananda lecture and talk and share. And I thought, well, I know all this. And that's many new devotees, newcomers to the path, think, well, it's so self-evident. Our soul knows it, but knowing it with your mind is very, very different than what Swami was sharing with us, because he lived it. And so to take this profound teaching and to realize, yes, there is recognition. There is recognition from the souls first emerging out from God. But nevertheless, we have to learn how to live it, how to become it. And that's what the great teachers help us to do. And so Swami also, and this is so important for us to follow his example, throughout the book, oftentimes he'll recount a story or an episode, and then he'll say, "But this was fraught with meaning." And you could just take it. Some of the things were so seemingly casual, but Swami was always looking, what's Master trying to tell me? What's he trying to teach me? Nothing is random. And in our lives, yes, we don't have a living guru in the body, but we have a living guru in spirit. And look at the events in your life, the good things, the bad things. Try to, as Swami said, they are fraught with meaning. And he lived his whole life that way. Always, what is Master trying to teach me? What was he saying? Once Jyotish and I were walking with him in the lower garden at Crystal Hermitage, and which when he was in residence here, he would very often, almost daily, invite us to come and walk with him at about 5 o'clock at tea time, have tea and then walk in the garden. And so one day, and sometimes others would join us as well. One day it was just Jyotish and me, and Swami, we were walking next to Swamiji, and then he just stopped, and he got a very distant look in his eyes, and he said, "Oh, that's what he meant." And we didn't say anything, and we kept walking, and then later we sat down, and he said, "I was remembering being in Master's presence with a small group of the monks, and he said something to one of the monks, but then he just looked at me with a meaningful glance, and I knew he was really saying it to me. Now I understand." That had been nearly 60 years prior. And he was always in conversation, always thinking, what did that mean? How can, how can I understand this better? And then in writing the book, Conversations, there's a very, and I recommend you all to read it, really. It's the wisdom and the examples and the stories are not to be found anywhere else, anywhere. But he, in the introduction, the preface to the book, Swami said, when I was with Master from 1948, was when Swamiji came, till 1952, March 7th, when Master left his body, he said, often he would say to me, write that down. Take that, write down what I say, Walter. I've never said this before, right? And so he kept voluminous notebooks of everything Master said, not only when he was present, but he heard stories from others as well. And he cherished these. These notebooks were his prized possession. And I remember when at Crystal Hermitage, his home there, he had a fireproof safe in his closet. And that's when he kept all those notebooks. And when he moved to Italy, he took those notebooks with him. And in fact, he wrote the book while he was in our center in outside of Assisi. But he said, it took me nearly 50 years to write these down. And why, you might ask, did I wait so long? And he said, with such humility and such a model for all of us, he said, I didn't feel like I understood them well enough. And it took me 50 years to really feel that I could share these teachings or these conversations with others. So one assumes from that, he was thinking about it. He was trying to draw the meaning out of these conversations. And so that's how he approached his conversation with Yogananda, ongoing from the moment he met him to the last breath Swamiji took. Always, I believe, he was in conversation with Yogananda. And that's what we should strive to be, living in that way. And then finally, as an overall theme, and then we'll talk about different aspects that we find in the book, is that Swami absorbed Master's teachings of how to live. As we, if you've read The New Path, Swami's autobiography, excuse me, he says how early on, and just months after being there, Swami had him teaching and giving Kriya initiation after he only had one himself. And then in charge of the monks, in charge of many aspects. And Master also told him, you have a great work to do. And he was training him in the time he had left, the time Master had left, it was just 3.5 years, to be able to work in the same way that Master had trained all of them. And Swami, it took me some years before I understood how Swami worked. I will never say who Swami was or what his consciousness was, but I began to see, oh, this is how he works with people. This is how he guides us. This is how he trains us spiritually. This is how he supports us. And so Swami took that training, that ongoing conversation with his guru, and he imparted it to all of us. And to the extent that we can, we try to continue to impart the way he worked because it works. It brings people on the spiritual path. If their karma is such, it helps them to stay on the spiritual path, and it enables them to spread Master's teachings in the way he did, spontaneously, joyfully, lovingly, with no barriers between people, just the flow of God's grace. That's how Master did it, that's how Swami did it, and that's how he trained us to do it and how we strive to do it. So that's kind of what, on an overview, what we gleaned from studying this book. I'm going to take a sip of water here. Thank you for bearing with me. Okay, so what are some of the themes now that we see in the book, we see in Swami's life, how he trained us. One is how to help people right where they are on the spiritual path, how to make them feel they have nothing to be ashamed of, that our mistakes are not hindrances unless we let them be. And there's a story that in the book of when Master was at Ranchi, working with the young students there, and one boy was a smoker. He must have been a slightly older student. And Master said, of course that's not a good habit for a yogi to practice, but I knew if I said, don't do it, he would sneak out behind the proverbial barn and smoke anyway. And so Master said to him, with that incredible insight and wisdom, he said, you can smoke, but do it in my presence. And what wisdom. Don't be ashamed of it. It's a habit you have. I don't identify it with you, nor should you. Do it in my presence. And he said the young man, boy, two or three times came, brought a cigarette, lit it, and did smoke in Master's presence. But after that, he never did it again. And so what wisdom, because we all come to the spiritual path with baggage, heavy baggage filled with karma. And if our teacher says, oh my, you do this and you do that and all of these things, we'll just turn around and go home. But to say, we welcome you as you are. This is not a good habit, but do it in front of me because I will, I can raise your consciousness and you, and help you to let it go. And similarly, Swami did this. We watched him many times working with people in this way, people that were really making blatant mistakes. And he didn't approve, he didn't look the other way, but he drew them nearer to him. So that in his magnetism, and these were people with spiritual potential, I need to say, and in his magnetism, most of them were able to transcend it. Not all, and that's the sad thing. But in the last years of his life, a woman came to Swami, and she was from a high social class, but a very deep and very sincere seeker. And she said to him, you know, I'm invited to cocktail parties and they serve cocktails and I must say I enjoy them. And Swami was just so sweet with her. He said, well, that's all right. You can continue to drink, but just remember, alcohol is tamasic. It pulls your energy down. That's all he said. And this woman, who's a dear friend of ours, said, from that moment on, I never had any desire even to pick up any alcoholic beverage. And I was often offered it. So what happened there? He made her feel accepted. He didn't make her feel, oh, that's such a tender thing, I cringe, no one can see it and no one can look at it. But he just, it's tamasic. Not you're bad, that's an evil habit, you shouldn't be a yogi. Just, it's not in your best interest. And she, in that moment, she told that desire for alcohol totally went away. So to accept people where they are. And then also, the next point is to accept that everyone has free will. We cannot control what people do. Swami never tried. And believe me, there were times that he wanted to because he knew the suffering coming. But there's a story in Conversations of a sincere disciple of Master who came and asked to be accepted into the monastic order. And Master saw his karma and he said, tell him if he stays, he will find liberation in this lifetime. And that's a powerful thing to say. And they went and told the man this. But then the man was wavering and he, oh, I have elderly parents and maybe I should go and take care of them and fulfill this worldly responsibility. And they came and told Master, "He's wavering, sir, he's not sure." And Master said, "That is his choice to make." Even though he knew he would find liberation in that life. And the man did leave. And he's led a life not fulfilling that promise that Master held out. And so acknowledging that we all have free will. In the early days of Ananda, there was a woman who lived here. She really was very marginally on the path. And I think in the early days of Ananda, the bar was a lot lower for we to move here. And then at a certain point, in fact, it was when the fire came, she said, "You know, I don't want to live here anymore. It's not fun anymore." And I didn't even know that Swami knew her that much because she wasn't a very dynamic devotee, very active. But then someone came and told Swami, "This woman is leaving." And he just became very still. And he said, "Very well, I will withdraw my ray." And I was very surprised because she didn't seem like she was that much following the path, but he was respecting that that was her choice now. And even though the fact that she lived here, he had imparted his vibration there. It was a very, I've never forgotten that story. Very, very interesting. And there have been a number of people that Swami gave a lot of personal energy to, spent a lot of time with. There was one man who, I doubt that he's watching. I won't use his name, but it was a long time ago. And he wanted to marry a woman. And Swami said, "Very well, if you feel to marry her, but she will take you off the path." And she did. And they stayed for a while. And Swami tried to help them. But when they left, I said to Swami, "Maybe it was for the best, Swami. You know, he wasn't happy anymore living here." And Swami said, "How can you say that? When I think of the suffering he's going to have in the world, I cried all night." Swami said that. And so, and yet he didn't, he respected his free will. He accepted it. That's where his karma is leading. The world will have to be his teacher, as we read that line about Kumar in Autobiography of a Yogi, and Sri Yukteswar said it of that young disciple. And so, again, that the theme of the masters see our karma, and they try to help us, but we have, that's, as Master said of that young monk, that's his decision to make. And they can't override our free will. They can try to lift our consciousness, but if liberation did not entail a choice on our part, and in fact sacrifices on our part, everyone would have it. But as we know, everyone doesn't have it because their free will intervenes. Another aspect that we read is the constant forgiving. When many people betrayed Master in his life, took lawsuits against him, accused him of unjustly of many things, but there was never any lingering rancor towards them. In fact, one of the last days of Master's life, there was a man, Swami Dhirananda was his name, an Indian that Master knew in India, and came over and Master set him up as a teacher and so forth. But he turned against Master and really caused a lot of problems for him. One of the last days of Master's life, they happened to meet, quote, and Master just looked at him, and there happened to be a photographer standing there, and Master looked at him with so much love and said, "Remember, I will love you always." And the man looks very hard and defensive, but there was never any hint, "You have hurt me and my love is withdrawn." Never. "I will love you always." And similarly with Swami, believe me, many people turned against him. Many people caused him great pain, as Jaya referred to yesterday. But there was never rancor. There was always that ongoing love. "Even if you don't love me, I love you." There was an amusing story of a man that came in the early years of Ananda. Whenever, you know, it happens so often when we talk about the early years of Ananda, it sounds like the Wild West. And it was, believe me. People, all sorts of people came. But it was a good show, very good movie. And this man had been a Hell's Angel. And he looked it. And yet, he read autobiography and he was drawn to Master. Swami gave him the name Ram Leela, God's play, because he was just quite a character. And in fact, once he said to Swami, "You know, Swami, if anybody ever threatens you or is your enemy, let me know, because I have people who know how to handle this." And Swami said, "Well, thank you very much, but I don't think we'll need your friends to intervene here." But this man did pretty well for a while, but then his old karma caught him, and because he couldn't live the spiritual life, he denounced Ananda and Swami and so forth. But then one day, it was during a big public event, and Swami was giving a class, and there were several hundred people. It was outside at the meditation retreat. And all of a sudden, at the very back of the area, seating area, there was Ram Leela looking very, very shamefaced. And Swami looked up and he saw him and he said, "Ram Leela." And he had to walk down that long aisle with hundreds of eyes looking at him. And Swami looked at him and he said, "You've been a bad boy, haven't you?" And Ram Leela said, "Yes, Swami, I won't do it again." And Swami took his hair and he just kind of shook it and he said, "Very good. That's the end." He didn't stay with us, but he kept in touch, and in a very positive way over the years. So that was a lovely story. Another time a man was, again, he came and wanted to be in charge of Ananda, and he's kind of edging with power, you know, towards Swami. And no one supported that. And so he was leaving and he spoke against Swami. And Swami saw him at some gathering. It was a public hearing where Ananda was trying to get present a master plan, and this man Jim was speaking against us. And afterwards, Swami went up to him and he said, "You know, Jim, I could be Satan incarnate, but it's not your problem. Why dwell on it?" And again, we were standing there when he did it, and when I saw Swami going up to him, my heart kind of clenched. Oh God, what's going to happen? But it just was so sweet, and it was such a wonderful lesson. And then another aspect from the book and how Swami trained us was a balanced life. You know, and you read again and again, people are coming to Master and saying, "Oh, there's this fast and raw food and all this," and he just, like Sri Yukteswar, throw the dog a bone. And his life was very balanced. And once one of the monks said to him, "Maybe we should try to live more austerely like St. Francis did, with, you know, poverty and owning nothing." And I mean, they had very little, the monastics, but they had a comfortable place to sleep. They weren't just outside on the hillside. And Master said, "When God gives more, take it." And that's how Swami had a wonderful sense of refinement and beauty. But it wasn't for the things in and of themselves. It was just to express God's beauty in everything. And Swami loved good food. But if he didn't eat, he wouldn't have cared. But he was so generous. I remember, actually, on Saturday, Jyotish and I are going to have our 46th wedding anniversary. And I remember, as a wedding present, he gave us these two beautiful little Chinese porcelain cups with a little bird painted on them. They were so delicate and so beautiful. And then just the end of the story, those two little cups were in our house when the forest fire hit, and everything burned. The cast iron stove melted. A jar of coins that we had melted. But when we were going through the ashes, those two little porcelain cups were intact. They were, the glaze on the outside was bubbled. They were, obviously they had a hot time of it, but there they were, as though God saying, see, the blessings, nothing changes that. So to live a life of simplicity, of self-control, as our, of cooperative obedience, but not harsh self-denial, and to God is joy. And if we can not cling to his world, but when God gives more, take it. And then there's the quality of perseverance. And there's the story, it's portrayed in the movie, very well done, The Answer, when Master, after some guests had had lunch with them, and Master was sitting with Swamiji, and he flicked a fork. He was trying to get the fork to dive into a glass, drinking glass. And he kept doing it, and it went off and off. Finally, it hit the rim. But finally, after many tries, it went in. But when it went in, the glass broke. But Master very proudly said to Swami, but I got it in. And you can say, well, that's just a silly story. You know, an amusing story of Master doing something kind of to pass the time. But Swami didn't take it that way. He said it was fraught with meaning. I mean, something as trivial as that, fraught with meaning. Because I knew he was telling me, if you start something, continue till you do it, no matter what the cost. And that really was the story of Swamiji's life. He started out as Master's disciple, fulfilling Master's wishes for him. And then the huge, when he was expelled from SRF, but he kept persevering. I will continue to serve you, Master. I will continue to share your teachings, even though the form may change. The form may change, but I will persevere through all of life's changes. And this is what Swami taught us to do as well. We've gone through many tests at Ananda, fire and legal battles and all these things. But through it all, there was the continuity and perseverance. None of this can touch my devotion. None of this can touch my search for God. And yes, the forms in our life will change. The bodies become broken or old or not very functional. But nevertheless, that doesn't matter. We keep trying. Gyanamata is such a beautiful example of this, where, you know, she could barely move, barely, and she was trying to do her energization exercises in bed. But it really, having been on the path all these years, I do want to tell you, you gain momentum. If you keep persevering, when obstacles come, you just say, okay, here's another one. Let's meditate. And maybe everything that I know is gone. Let's meditate. And with God's grace, at the end of our life, when the glass is really broken, when we cast off the body, we can say, let's merge with God. It's what we've been doing our whole life. And this was the example of Master, his life, Swami of his life, and what they gave to us. And then two more points. To respect the God in all. And, you know, there's so many stories of Master. One man was a fundamental Christian, and he was expounding, you know, in the Garden of Eden, and in those days snakes could talk and all that sort of thing. And Master just took off his hat and he said, I bow to the temple of colossal ignorance that I see in you. But always respecting the individual. And Swami recounts in this book, Conversations, that he also recounts it in his autobiography, The New Path. The day before Master passed, or the last days, I should say, I think it was March 5th, he had his last satsang with the monks, and he gave them quite a bit of advice. But the very last bit of advice that he gave them, and this was his closing words, was treat each other with the respect with which you have given me. That was the last thing he said to them. Because in that respect, there's no judgment, there's acceptance, there's unity, there's the magnetic connection that we have with each other. And with Swamiji, it took me a while, coming as a young person, never having met anyone like him in my life, it took me a while to understand the respect with which he treated us. Because we certainly didn't feel worthy of any spiritual respect. But he saw our soul's destiny, and he saw the good karma that brought all of us and all of you to the spiritual path. And he respected that. And even if we fell flat on our faces, that's not what he saw. He saw only that God dwelled within us. And as I say, it took me a while to see that. Jyotish and I were very blessed to spend a lot of time with him personally and alone with just the two of us. Never once did I see a break in that. Never once did he treat us in a frivolous way. He was jovial. He enjoyed a good joke and all that. But there was always a centeredness in the self. And he related from that center in himself to that center in in us. And again, not with formality or stiffness or anything like that. You felt, you felt you could be more yourself with him than anybody else in the world. Not your lower self, but your higher self, your true self. And it was such a liberating experience. And just as Master told the monks, treat each other with the respect that you have offered me. It's not enough to go in your meditation room and give your devotion to God. You have to come out of your meditation room and give your respect and high opinion to everyone you meet, wise or foolish. And if we can live that way, then again, we're in constant conversation with Yogananda, because that's how he behaved. And then finally, the theme of impersonal love, different from respect. And Swami recounts a story that once someone asked, they actually asked Swami, why does Master give such special, particular affection and attention to Rajarshi, Janakananda, St. Lynn? And Swami answered, because he's advanced enough that he doesn't take it personally. If he gave it to others, it would go to their head. But because Rajasi had transcended ego, that he accepted that love from God and Master to the God in him. And the same with Swami, his impersonal love. Some people during his lifetime might have thought, oh, well, he spends a whole lot of time with that person. They must have, they must be special. You know, once we had gone, Swami was living in Assisi, and Jyotish and I had gone over to visit him there. And I was missing him a lot. We hadn't seen him for many months. And we got there, and he was writing and doing other things, and he didn't have a lot of time for us. And I was feeling a little, forlorn, a little abandoned, something like that. And then Swami saw me, and he said, remember, Devi, no one is special to me. I'm not even special to myself. And yet, was he unloving? Absolutely not. He loved everyone equally. And that's what I want to leave you with, to remember that as Swami was in conversation with Yogananda, if you want to feel that impersonal love that flows from Master and from Swamiji, then we need to understand that the source of that love is impersonal to the impersonal receptacle in our own hearts. It's the only way you can really feel the expansion of divine love and to realize what it is. It cannot be received on a personal level because the personal level diminishes it, shuts it down. But the impersonal love that is available, if we learn how to live in conversation with Yogananda, then it's always accessible to us. And remember, when towards the end of his life, when Swami was with Master out in the desert at 29 Palms, Swami asked him, "When you are gone, will you be as near to us as you are now?" And what did Master say? "To those who think me near, I will be near." And so, my friends, if you want to feel all these things we've been talking about, that acceptance and respect and forgiveness and unconditional impersonal love and all of these qualities, we have to think him near. Just as Swami, the spotlight of his mind was always turning on Master, God and Guru. And we need to realize that's the secret to everything we're looking for, everything we've strived for, to be in conversation. Remember, Master said that God is nearer than the nearest, dearer than the dearest. So near, so dear, just a thought away. And yet that thought is by our own free will. We have to think it. God or Guru can't think it for us. We have to choose to think, "Be thou the pole star of my life. Guide every detail, guide every action, and guide my soul to salvation and liberation by thy grace." Thank you.
Thank you, Devi. That was beautiful. You know, today is, how to put it, a little bit more informal than I think either Monday or Friday will be. On Monday we covered the autobiography of a yogi, and that is like Master showing us what a yogi really is. It's that vastness of consciousness. On Friday, we're going to cover the essence of the Bhagavad Gita, and that's Krishna and Arjuna, which is Babaji and Master, working together to show how to actually live and to move from confusion to enlightenment. And we'll go into that. But these two are grand themes, and it's almost like you get the impression of Master in the broadest cosmic viewpoint. But this little book is very different. This gives, as Swami said, conversations with Yogananda. It gives little glimpses. This is like 500, many of us wish, "Oh, if only I could have been with Master." Well, what would we have done with Master if we had been in his presence? You know, would we have had the wisdom to understand? What Swami has done here is to, under Master's direction, Master told him, "Write these things down." He wrote down little glimpses of Master so that we can see little interactions that Master had with people, with issues, with problems, so that it's like a living guide that we can see. And Davy talked about some. I'm going to talk about at least three elements in here. To continue in a sense of what Davy was saying, there was a time, recounted in here, where Swami and Master were together, and there was a man who was a Hollywood personality and a little bit pompous, and he had previously, Swami had worked with him trying to teach him, and he would be very accepting on the surface, but not really take it in and not do anything about it. And Swami eventually kind of got to feel that he was either a little insincere or even worse, hypocritical. At any rate, Master and Swami, it was one of the times that he was alone with Master while Master was working with someone, counseling them. And toward the end, this man thanked Master and left. And Master then turned to Swami and said, "How cold you were with him." Because Swami, of course, had this, let's face it, a little bit of an attitude. He was, let's get this in perspective. He was a young monk, probably 22 or 23 at the time. You know, so he was young, not completely matured in his attitudes yet. Anyway, Master said, "How cold you were with him. What would have happened with all of you if I had treated you like that?" Meaning, what would have happened to you if you felt from me a sense of rejection? Well, Master knew way better than Swami the difficulties in this person's personality and his behavior and his relationship to the path. But Master was trying to take a person exactly where he was and then move him along. And that's what I want to talk about a little bit. How do we work with other people, or much more importantly, how do we work with ourselves? How do we work with our tendencies? On Saturday, Davy and I had to do an errand in the nearby town, Nevada City. And as relatively often happens, when we go for a walk, try to go for a walk every day to maintain exercise. Well, we were in Nevada City, and there are some places there. There's an irrigation channel that goes for many, many miles. So water is brought from higher up in the Sierras through this irrigation channel and used for irrigation purposes. And so there are paths along this irrigation channel. The channel's about 5 feet wide or so. And so it's a concrete. Imagine what it looks like is that you're walking along a stream. And so there's a little concrete channel that goes down the two sides and then the bottom. And so I was walking along this channel, and I just noticed the sun was reflecting off the water, and there was a very, very interesting pattern in it. So there were, all the waves were like V-shaped, but not quite V, alternating like a crisscross pattern. And it was just very entrancing, and I was looking at it. But then the thought came into my mind, why is the surface of the water that way? Well, obviously, underneath the concrete had those kinds of ripples in it. So when they laid that concrete, whatever that section happened to be, there were those little bumps in it in a V-shaped pattern. And then another, I don't know, quarter of a mile long, the water was flowing smoothly. But I was reflecting on that surface turbulence or surface pattern. And our behavior, our emotions are like that. You know, they have a particular pattern. And if something underneath in our consciousness is ruffled, then the surface is going to be ruffled. And so many people or books or whatever suggest that you try to fix that surface pattern. You can't suppress it. You can't change it. You can't do anything really with that surface pattern because it's caused by the pattern underneath. Our behavior, our spiritual life, our habit patterns, our mentality, our attitudes, all of these are caused by the patterns that are underneath, and those patterns are formed by countless incarnations where we have had certain behavior patterns, and to a certain extent, those may have served us well in that lifetime. They may not serve us very well in this lifetime. And so maybe in a previous lifetime, just to take an example, one of the ways that we exerted control and exerted our freedom was that we would get angry whenever anyone confronted us. In fact, in this book, Conversations, Master tells a charming story from his youth. He was reminiscing toward the latter days. He said that one time in his youth, he enjoyed playing football or soccer with some other boys in the neighborhood. He was a very good athlete, very, very fast runner. But he enjoyed playing soccer. But these boys were rough and they swore a lot, cursed a lot. And Master told them, you know, I won't play with you anymore if you're going to have language like that. I just don't like it. And that made him mad because they were not highly refined boys. So there was a man in the neighborhood who everybody feared. His name was Jotin. And he would come and he would beat up people. And so these boys got Jotin to challenge, he was in the park and he was going to beat up Master. And so Master and a buddy were coming and Jotin was along the path and he had a big stick there. And Master's friend said, oh, we can't go there. He'll beat you up. He's terrible. And so Master said, we don't have anything to fear. But interestingly, Master didn't have any fear, but he wanted to help this person. And so he went and he prayed to Shiva to help him. And when he got the answer from Shiva that, yes, I'll help you, Shiva is the destroyer in this case of bad habits. Then Master walked in and there was Jotin again. And his friend said, oh, we can't go there. And Master said, no, I don't have any fear. And he went and Jotin was standing there in the path all ready to beat up Master and he had a stick. And Master just looked at him with deep acceptance and deep love. And Jotin kind of looked down and then he dropped his stick. And he said to Master, I have this terrible habit of anger. And it's causing me a lot of trouble because wherever I work, if the boss says something that I don't like, I'll slap him. And when I slap a boss, well, you can imagine the result. I get fired. So I can't keep a job. This was a grown man. Master was, I don't know, 12, 13 years old. So that's the exchange was taking place. Well, Jotin said, I have this terrible anger that just, I can't control it. Well, that's a ripple under the surface coming from past lifetimes. Well, Master said, well, I'll pray to help you overcome this. And he did. I won't go into the whole story because I'm trying to make the point here that how do we change those patterns that are in many cases formed in concrete that cause these surface patterns that create trouble for us and trouble for others? That's the real problem that devotees face, that all of us in life face. How do we work on those? Well, we have to be open to changing those patterns. if we aren't open to wanting them changed. And honestly, that is the biggest problem, because many, many of our patterns, you and I know that they're not good. We know that they cause us difficulties, and yet we don't want to change them. In fact, the definition of addiction is that there is something that you're doing or repeating that you know has adverse effects on your life, and yet you continue to do that. And that can be drug addiction, it can be sugar addiction, it can be anger addiction, it can be worry addiction, anxiety addiction, everything that you know is bad for you, but you continue to do so, is a kind of an addiction. So that addiction is a ripple in the concrete of your consciousness under the surface. How do we work with them? Well, the first thing is that we have to want to change them. If we don't, God Himself will not change them for us, because we have the free will to hold on to those or not. So our biggest thing is to sincerely want to change those. Then we have to do our part. As was quoted yesterday, I think Pranaba said it, the well-known formula, our part is 25% of the picture. The grace of the guru on our behalf, his effort on our behalf is 25%. 50% is the grace of God. But our part is that we have to want to change those things. And if we don't want to change them, we may even know that they're there, but still not be ready to work on something. If that's true, then accept that rather than trying to suppress the surface and pretend that those concrete formations aren't there under the surface of your mind. Accept the fact, I know that I have a pattern of anger, but I'm not ready to work on it yet. Or I know that I have a pattern of judging people, as Master was instructing Swami in this instance. I know I judge people, but I'm not ready to work on that yet. Then work on some that you do, but in meditation, and this, I can't stress how important this is, in meditation, turn your opened heart toward Master and say, Master, I want you to change me. I may not be ready to work on all of these yet, but you please at least soften me up so that I want to work on them, so that I'm ready to have them changed. Because if they don't change, you'll go on to your next lifetime with those same patterns, because those patterns you've brought from the last lifetime. So open yourself up to the grace of the guru and to the grace of God. That's the most important part of this. And then when you do that, then do what you can in your own life. But the most important thing is to open yourself to the flow of God's grace, because he will, if he doesn't, if you're too attached to those patterns, he won't rasp them out. He won't go in with some machine and clear out those concrete ripples. But there's a flow of grace that will soften them up, or he'll put you together. That's one reason that Master put us, suggested communities. Communities are like a rock tumbler. You take these rough stones and you put them together in a tumbler, and in that you have a kind of a mud that's got some very fine grit in it, and that rock tumbler tumbles and tumbles and tumbles. So life, daily interactions and daily learning experiences and everything that happens, you have to consciously ask to get stuck in that rock tumbler. So you have to do that much, but then the rest is God's motion to polish you up. And at the end, those rough, terrible-looking rocks come out, and they're beautiful gemstones. They're beautiful little agates. They're lustrous. They're gorgeous. And so we will become, but we have to first be ready. Our friend Jaya said that when people come to him for counseling, he doesn't always actually do this, but he said that what he likes to do, if they're ready, he says, when they come for counseling, he said, are you coming for advice or are you coming for support? If you're coming for support, I'll give you my support. If you're coming for advice, I will give you advice. But if you're really coming for support and you're pretending that you're asking for advice, I'd rather not waste the time, basically. Well, Davy and I have done a lot of counseling and we know exactly what he means, because some people come for counseling and they don't really want to hear anything different. They just want to be supported in whatever they're doing now. And Davy and I have learned to kind of ferret out whether they're wanting advice or support. And generally speaking, we give support because they aren't ready for advice. That means basically that the ripples underneath the surface, the patterns underneath the surface, have not softened enough yet for them to want to have them changed. And so we support them as Master did, as Swami did, as you should. So don't offer unsolicited advice. And even if people solicit advice, probably don't say very much. The best advice is to be supportive in a conversation and draw out of that person their own advice, higher self, their own higher self advising themselves. And then you can say, I think that's right. I think that's the way to go. Or you remain kind of silent in the background and just let them work. But the piece of advice that you can always give is pray about this. Take it into meditation. Turn toward God, because God will open you up enough so that you're, if not changed, you're now willing to be changed. And that's the point that you have to get to. But Master and Swami were very, very careful about not intruding past that kind of, I don't know, line. And we should be too. Did that mean that they didn't care? No, they cared deeply, deeply for people and for people's spiritual progress, because they saw how much pain those hardened concrete patterns underneath caused in a person's life. And they cared deeply about that. They just respected the process. So in working with yourself, Master will give you advice if you're open to it. That's why we gave the assignment with the autobiography. Read that, looking for what is Master saying to me. Same with this. Read this. What is Master trying to tell me? I don't recommend this as an ongoing practice, because it won't really work. But what I'm going to recommend for the homework assignment is a very, very simple one. That you take this book, or if you don't have this book, you take something where Master is speaking, and you pray to Master to show you something that you need to know. And then at random, open the book and read that and see if there is something there. But you have to be open. You have to meditate on what is said, because a lot of times it'll be obscure. Now, I don't want to present that too much as a practice, because I don't know, people want facile solutions to thorny issues. You have to really get into an introspective and self-analytical mood, mode where you have some clarity of consciousness so that you can perceive those samskars, those vrittis under the surface. And it's a facile solution to say, oh, I won't try to think it through. I'll just have Master answer it for me. Swami said sometimes with counseling, he would counsel people and he would say to us afterwards, they want me to figure out for them some problem that they're too lazy to figure out for themselves. And so they maybe have not tried to figure this out for 30 years, and then they come to me and they want me in 5 minutes to give them the answer. And so that's in that mode. I don't want to over recommend this. You've got to do the work yourself. But sometimes it's fun to see what Master has in mind for you. So do that, but don't do it kind of the way you might gaze into a crystal ball. Don't think that that's the absolute best way of answering the issues. Okay, enough of that. I want to go on. The next topic I want to talk about a little bit is about the balance of seva and meditation, and I want to talk about both of these. Master's path has both meditation and service in it. He said, our path is a balance of that. And so this week, the whole week, we're talking about how to live the yogic lifestyle. Let me start with the service part of this, because others yesterday, and we'll talk more about the meditative part on Friday, but let me talk a little bit more about the service, lest that gets missed in all of this. Service is absolutely essential. In fact, Master said that service is just as important as meditation, and that we should serve in such a way that our service becomes like meditation in action, and we should meditate in such a way that our meditation is also service. What does that mean? Master said one of the highest prayers is, Divine Mother, reveal yourself to me. Reveal yourself to me. Now that's meditation where you're trying to commune with Divine Mother, but he added another phrase to that. Reveal yourself to me, that I may reveal you to all. So that turns it from give me, give me, give me, to give me so that I may be a channel. And so that's a very good prayer to keep in mind for the balance of meditation and service. But let me talk about the service aspect of it. It is absolutely essential for us to serve others. Because in the service, in true service of other people, we become self-forgetful. One time, somebody came to him and said, why am I struggling with this so much? Why is it causing so much pain? And Swami said, it's ego. And the person said, well, I didn't think I was egoic about this. And Swami said, every problem stems to ego. Every problem stems to ego. Ego is a sense of separation. Well, now let's look at service. If you're thinking about yourself, if you're asking, even in a sincere spiritual way, give me, give me, give me, that energy that should be expanding is contracting. And so if you're thinking about yourself in whatever thing, if your mind starts to ruminate, and especially if you start to get into a pattern of, oh, poor me, oh, Divine Mother is so mean. Oh, I don't deserve this. Oh, and you're pushing things away. Swami, one time somebody said, because Swami had a lot of physical things to overcome. He was taking on people's karma, but he had a lot of physical problems. And one time someone said, a little bit jokingly to him, said, oh, Swami, Divine Mother is just unfair to you. And Swami got really stern. He said, never say that. Never say that. Divine Mother gives me exactly what is good for me. And so when you start thinking about yourself or lamenting your conditions or getting self-focused, try to battle against that. Try to neutralize. That's a ripple in the concrete under the surface caused by thinking about yourself in the past and thinking about yourself in the present. Try to neutralize that ripple by affirming that everything that comes to you in life is Divine Mother's gift given to you out of love. And if it's difficult, it's difficult because there's some egoic resistance in you that is battling against that. And so, especially when you find yourself too self-involved, too self-focused, break that pattern by serving others. There are thousands of pieces of advice and teachings about this, but Swami gave us so many little like conversations with this. He said that if you have a pattern that's causing you problems, you can't just immediately stop that pattern, but take that pattern and do unto others that which you would like to have done to yourself in that. So he said, if you have a desire, I mean, this is in a sense a kind of a trivial thing, but he said, if you have a desire to buy something and you can't get rid of that desire, then go ahead and buy it and give it to someone else. Okay, now coming back to service, if you have a desire for something to be given to you, then give that very thing to others. Are you feeling lonely? Then help somebody else that's feeling lonely not to feel lonely. Are you feeling that you don't have enough material wealth? Are you feeling threatened on a material plane? As odd as this sounds, the piece of advice to overcome that is give some funds to somebody else who's worse off than you are. In the midst of your contractive worry or concern about yourself, find the seat or the seed of what is bothering you and give that to somebody else. That's true service. Now, ultimately, by serving other people, you have to be careful not to do it out of selfish motive. Well, I won't take the time to read. Master in here said, don't do things for other people in order to get something for yourself. So don't serve somebody else and then be looking over your shoulder and wondering if everybody is noticing your wonderful service to other people. Look at me. Oh, don't look at me. I don't want you to look at me. I'm just here serving, you know. I'm serving, so don't look at me. Don't look at me, you know. So you don't want to serve in such a way that it's self-taking. You want to be forgetful in it. But Master says, if you aren't able to do that, serve anyway, even out of the wrong motive, because that service to others, even if it's look at me while I'm serving, you're still opening up, you're still expanding. And so give that away which you feel that you need. Now, That's the first level of service. And as you do so, your consciousness, your heart, which is going to lead, your heart will expand. And you will begin, in the act of service, you will begin to really care about the people that you're serving. If you start teaching young children, you will start falling in love with those young children you're teaching and really, really begin to care about their welfare and their learning process. And in that, you become self-forgetful. That's the first level of it. The second level of it is try to see that you're not serving the children. You're not, any act of service is better if you think, if you can hold the consciousness that you're serving your master, serving your guru, or serving God in the service of this. So try in your service to hold on to the attitude, I'm doing this for you, Master. I'm doing this for you, God. So during the day, all of us probably who are watching this, we're high-minded people. And so high-minded people naturally serve others. And so I'm in a sense speaking to the choir here, but we naturally serve others, but try to bring it to the next level of consciousness where you do whatever you're doing, all work, every activity, try to bring it to the consciousness that I'm doing this for you, Master. I'm doing this work as an offering for you. And you may find that there are things that you don't want to do, but it's your duty, or you see that they need to be done. Then you have a choice. Oh, I don't like it, but I know it needs to be done. Which are you going to opt for? Oh, I don't like it. I'm not going to do that. Or, I don't like it, but it needs to be done. Let me do it. I'm going to do it for you, Master. I'm going to do it for other people. So that's the second level of service, where you're really, and it has to be sincere, it has to be real, where you really are offering everything that you do, or as often as you can remember it, you're offering that as an offering, a self-offering, a yajna, a fire ceremony of self-offering to the guru. And that will burn up the karmic patterns. It will burn up. It will change those ripples in the concrete that are causing the patterns on the surface of your behavior and your consciousness. So offer service to others as level one, service to the guru in others as level two, and then there's a third level that you should try to remember. And this probably honestly can't be done without also deep meditation, because otherwise the ego is too active. But the third level is to understand that you aren't doing anything. You aren't serving. It's all God. There's only one player in this whole drama, and that single player is God. And so you may think that, oh, I'm doing this, look at me, that is better than nothing. Or I'm serving the guru, that's even better. But who's serving whom? It's God serving God. Master said that so beautifully. Toward the end of his life, he was taking on karma for people. And it expressed itself physically as difficulties with his legs. But Master said that he was taking on karma and in the form of astral entities. He said astral entities were coming in the shape of corkscrews and saws, and they were screwing into his bones and sawing on his bones, those astral entities, and he was neutralizing those astral patterns for his disciples. At any rate, he didn't talk about that openly. He just mentioned it one time and Swami quotes it in here. But he couldn't walk at times, and so the disciples would carry him. And one time they were carrying him down the stairs, and he was saying, "Oh, thank you for your many services to me." And they said, "Oh, Master, Master, it's you who are serving us." And he just smiled and he said, "God serving God, that's his drama." See, that's the higher level, that there's only one thing, there's only God serving God. And in that state, when we do the service, it will be completely clearing for us. See, the holding on to any thought of the self maintains those ripples under the surface. But when we say that it's only God serving God, then God can really flow through and clear those things out. Without that, we can't achieve the highest states of consciousness as long as there are ripples underneath, or karmic samskars underneath the flow of that grace. Master said, when somebody asked him, "Give me samadhi," Master looked at him and said, "Could you take it if I gave it to you?" The disciple looked down and said, "No, Master." Master said that until you're ready, they quoted that yesterday, until your karma, until your mind and it's really the astral spine is cleared out by the practice of kriya or meditative techniques and devotion, until it's cleared out, it would burn up your nervous system to have that flow of energy. Just a little visual example. There was a time, there's a Hoover Dam and a huge lake behind it. Normally, Hoover Dam is a huge dam for hydroelectric power and so on. Well, there was a huge rain and snow year. And so the dam built up and built up, the lake built up and built up, until it was going to overflow over the dam, which could erode the top of the dam and break it down. So Hoover Dam has, as all dams do, they have channels on the side to take the overflow. Well, Hoover Dam, being huge, have these huge tunnels built into the rock into which it's built. And so those spillways, the water had risen to the point where it was flowing into those spillways, and they started hearing this kind of rumbling sound. And the engineer said, we have to shut off the spillways. So they managed with plywood to build up the dam and shut off the spillways. In the spillways, when they were dried, they went in, and they found that the concrete in there was breaking down. And they traced that back. And the reason the concrete was breaking down is that when they built that bottom of that spillway, at one point there was a little nut about, that they had used to tie things down. And that was protruding up. And that huge rush of water hitting that nut created turbulence. It's called cavitation. And all of those bubbles crashing together, they explode at the speed of sound. And so all of that energy coming down was causing the concrete to break down, and then it was causing more cavitation until they were finding these huge holes. If they had let it go for another day, it would have broken down the whole side of the mountain. Now that is why we can't get samadhi when we've got these patterns underneath the surface, that it would break down our nervous system. So we have to clear ourselves out. And that's the process of meditation and of service and of the whole of the spiritual path. Most importantly, as we've been talking about this week, the most important thing we can do is get in tune with the Guru. He'll train us. He'll soften us. He'll smooth out those things. And we can't do it on our own. We can't lift ourselves up. So get in tune with the guru. And that's our major process of what should be happening in meditation. Try to do meditation, do your techniques, your kriya, your whatever you do, as well as you possibly can. But know that your mind is going to wander. Know that you're going to be restless because you haven't yet cleared out that channel. But every time you meditate, it clears out past karma. Every kriya clears out past karma until you become more and more open. But the real openness should be at the end of techniques, a sense of complete self-offering to God. Now, you don't know what the patterns are necessarily under the surface, but in that state where you're softened, where your heart is open, where your mind is open to attunement with the guru, in that state, try to have complete self-offering. Now, it may take the form of trying to project your consciousness through the light you see at the spiritual eye. It may take the form of trying to feel joy. Master said meditation is deep concentration on God or on any one of the eight aspects of God. Light, listening to Om, feeling joy. Any of those, try to be absorbed into that. And if you do that, and the attunement with the guru is what will bring you there. He's the channel to bring you to God. So attunement with him in deep meditation, deep self-offering, sincere desire to have whatever patterns are holding you back cleared out. That's the way. And what will be the result of that is that there will be, if not on the surface yet, there will be a growing intense yearning for God to enter into your life and to completely change you. You may not be changed yet, but I can guarantee you, do this process, and the intensity of your yearning for God and for self-realization will grow, and along with it will come joy and love and friendship and all of the qualities that Yoganandaji talks about in here. So, as Devi said, be in constant conversation, if you can be, as much as you can be. Be in conversation with God and Guru. And if you do, they will guide your consciousness and they will open your heart and they will change those patterns under the surface that you do not see and don't even maybe know exist. They will smooth them out. You don't need to understand the process. We think, oh, I've got to understand this. One time I said that to Swami. He was giving me some advice. I said, I understand, Swami. He said, I don't care if you understand. I want you to change. Understanding is overrated. Offer yourself. Plead with God. Plead with Master. Change me. Change me to that which is a perfect reflection of thee. So, let's end today's session as we did before by taking the light and the joy that we feel, the uplifted consciousness, and sending that out to the world, which also yearns for upliftment, even though they may not know and may not know how to ask. Let's send it in any case. That's God's way, isn't it? So get centered in yourself. Let's pray. Divine Mother, thou art omnipresent. Thou art in all thy children. Manifest thy healing presence in body, mind, and soul. Rub your hands together, generating energy. Now feel that energy in your palms as if now project that out. by chanting Om. Shanti, shanti, shanti. And just a reminder that at 4 o'clock this afternoon, Devi and I will be taking from 4 to 5 an hour to answer questions. So if there are questions you'd like answered, just send them in and we'll get to as many of them as we can. God bless you.